Blog Talk Radio
presents the Blog Radio Show. Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and I thank you so much for hanging out with me. You could be doing anything else, but you're here listening to me and my guests, and we're going to have a great time. We are, we're going to call it COVID Radio. We're still tail-ending the COVID, and sorry we had to cancel yesterday's show. Did my best and only canceled two. But both that were done in out of bed. It was a Joan Rivers interview. But anyway, tonight we are going to have a great show. I'm so excited to welcome acclaimed author Douglas Wellman. And he is just a jack of all trades. He's just an author. And he was a production, production manager on some great sitcoms. He's also done, worked on a lot of stand-up TV shows that was comedy shows. We've seen, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about his new book, The Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Basha Freilich and the Will to Live. His other books I'm interested in, particularly one of them, is The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. And, of course, 5 Minutes, Mr. Biner. I love John Biner. And God Sent Me, A Woman Missionary in the Jungle. I'm curious about that one. For sure, and Surviving Hiroshima, A Young Woman's Story. That's just a few things that Douglas has niched in his belt, but we are definitely going to talk about everything. So I hope Douglas is ready for me, and you guys are ready, and we're going to have a great time. So without further ado, please welcome author, production manager, and a jack of all trades in the industry, entertainment, and just philosophicals. He's also a chaplain. I mean, we got so much to cover here, folks. Mr. Douglas Wellman, welcome to the show. Douglas, how are you, sir?
I'm excellent, Joanne. I've been looking forward to doing the show, and now I finally get a chance to do it. I'm very happy about that.
Absolutely, I am too, and I appreciate you joining me. I really do, because I was looking forward to doing it myself, because not only did I want to talk to you about all these amazing things, but I just love being on the air and being here for our listeners, and I had to cancel a few shows, and I hate when that happens. So you got to tell me how you went from entertainment industry into writing, and you're really like a historian, a history buff, right? I mean, so of World War II.
Yes.
So, yeah, but let's want to start from the beginning.
Well, you know, I say that I spent most of my adult life in the world of comedy, and then I've gone into the field of human misery, and I call that a balanced life. So I guess that's what that comes from.
As
a kid, I was always interested in comedy, just based on the fact that I liked laughing more than, you know, being miserable.
Well, of course.
It shouldn't take too much to figure that out.
Exactly.
And then I also, when I was in college, got very interested in television, so I thought, I wonder if there's any way to slam these two things together. And also, when I was very young, I started writing, and, you know, my father found an ancient typewriter that he had, and I was about, I don't know, 8 years old, and so off I went. So, so between writing, television, and just a general love of comedy, that was kind of, you know, when I was in college, just getting a job anywhere in television was what I wanted to do. I was living in, you know, Minneapolis. And I did manage to get jobs at two television stations. They were local stations, and back in those days, there could be enormous fun in working at a local TV station.
Right.
Because they weren't always owned, they weren't owned by big corporations. In fact, back then, the FCC limited the number of broadcast licenses to 7 that any entity could own. So the stations, even the big stations, it was a little casual, fun family thing. I enjoyed that tremendously. And then I decided, I was working with another director one night. I was helping him on something, and it was like 3 a.m. And we were talking, and he said, you know, I was in New York, and I decided I was going to go to Los Angeles, but I stopped here in Minneapolis, and I liked it. So I stayed here, but I always wondered what would have happened if I would have gone to Los Angeles. And I thought, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So I packed my bag, and off I went to Los Angeles. And
how old were you?
You know,
old were you at the time, Douglas?
I was 27, and I didn't know anyone in L.A.
Wow.
And I actually went back to Minneapolis briefly, and then came back again when I was in 29, just in time for the actors' strike, just to make certain that I couldn't possibly get any work. But that worked out, too, because I ended up getting a job running a recording studio for a while, and that was fun.
Very cool.
And then I just kind of, I was just poking around trying to find anybody who'd pay attention to me. And there was a guy at a particular studio who kept saying that he wanted to hire me as an associate producer. And then one day he called me and said, you know, I don't think this company is ever going to get a project off the ground, but there's some people downstairs I think you could meet. And that's how I'd been a director back in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but they offered me a production manager job doing sitcoms. Well, I wasn't going to turn that down. So I went.
Wow.
And that's where it started.
Yeah, and great sitcoms, too, not just something obscure that we never heard of. I mean, these are mainstream sitcoms that everybody grew up, loved watching, and is still enjoying reruns on, you know. So,
oh,
I mean,
yeah.
What,
I
Facts
actually,
of Life? Yeah, Facts of Life,
yeah,
50
you know,
Strokes. I mean, which was
in
Nell,
a moment
which,
of ego. In a moment of ego, I saw a rerun of The Facts of Life on one of the channels. And so I hit record just to see my name go by. You know, you can tell that you really need some emotional support when you're doing stuff like that.
Right.
That is the nicest.
I was going to ask you about the show. Did you think it was going to be a huge hit? I guess you don't really think any of the shows are going to be huge. I mean,
you never know
anything. You're talking 30 years later, did you ever think that these shows would still have an effect on people is what I guess I'm getting at.
I was doing The Facts of Life and Give Me a Break at the same time. And it's always nothing more fun than doing multiple things at the same time. Well, I did enjoy it. I can't argue about it. But Give Me a Break was it's in its first season, and starting off, the ratings were pretty abysmal. And I would get a little note from the studio every week when the ratings came out, and they'd say, "Well, it won't be long now. We'll see if we can find something this way." Well, that show just took off. It suddenly took off, and. When they finally sold that show into syndication, I think they got the largest amount of money at that time.
At that time.
The sitcom, It was Mort Lachman did that one. I mean, he was a nice man, too. But The Facts of Life, I think, was probably the nicest show I did. You know, the girls were nice. The producers were nice. The directors or the writers, everybody was nice. It was just like dripping with nicety. And that was pretty much the last time that happened, but it was great fun. It was a wonderful show.
Yeah, well, you answered my question. I was going to ask you, which one did you enjoy working on the most? I'm sure you enjoyed them all, but there's the answer. You liked working on that set, Facts of Life, and with those people.
Yeah, that was the nicest one where I could go in there, I would know that I'm not going to argue with anybody. It's all going to be nice. Everybody's going to have fun. They're going to tell jokes to one another. And then, you know, then you have the other shows where you say, well, okay, I'm going to go to the studio and I'm probably not going to have lunch or dinner or get back until the middle of the night. And we're going to be yelling at one another all day. And those right. aren't so much fun, but they come up. They come up. And, you know, in a way, even that, it's certainly interesting. I mean, you can't say it's not interesting.
Exactly. Right, right. Of course. Every day is different, and who knows what each one brings. Now, what I wanted to say, too, now, are you still involved with the Emmys or no? Do you still work with them or no? You totally lost touch with the...
I retired from that business. The last pilot I did, actually, was in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was also the assistant dean at the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts.
I know.
So I retired from that.
How did you do that at the same time? My goodness.
It was challenging. But, you know, I'm just one of those people that if I don't have 10 things to do at the same time, I don't feel fulfilled, I guess.
No.
But, but I did. I left the business and I, took a honorary withdrawal from the Producers Guild.
Yeah.
And then just last week, I got a call about one of my books. And they said, well, if you do this thing, if you want to get back in the Producers Guild, you come in as a producer as well. So I don't know. Who knows?
Wow. Well, let's hope
it's
they pick it up. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm so sorry.
Right. You never know. But you never know. And people are always saying, well, you know, let's do this and let's do that. And then you wait.
Right.
And sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. But at this stage of my life, I enjoy everything. I mean, I just
right.
enjoy everything. So
well,
I don't.
Doesn't happen.
It's okay with me.
Working with the comics, doing those comedy shows had to be a far cry from working with the folks on the sitcoms, I would think. I think that will be a little more wild, no?
Oh, good guess, Joanne. Excellent.
Yeah, Comic Strip Live, Comedy on the Road. I mean, Girls Night Out. Crazy stuff.
Those were huge fun times because at one time I was shooting one series in Los Angeles, another series in New York, and traveling on a third series all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, half the time I was on airplanes. But
right.
when I would get to wherever I was going, whoever, I'd cast in the show, then all my friends, I always knew somebody and in the cast that I was relatively close to. And so it was kind of fun. When John Byner and I were doing Comedy on the Road, it was just enormous fun. You imagine two guys sitting in a restaurant in the middle of the night telling stories about strange career happenings, and we just
he was hysterical, and so the story, the book about John is 5 minutes, Mr. Byner. I mean, is it all true or is it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. When John and I, we shot the last episode of Comedy on the Road. I don't remember when we shot it. But we got back to the Los Angeles airport, and we walked out of the airport together, and John's wife was there, and a friend of mine, my girlfriend, was there to pick me up. And I turned to John and said, John, you know, you've had such a great life. We've had so much fun. If you decide you want to write a book, get a hold of me. And
right.
so he did that 25 years later. So better late than never.
Right. Well, what's he doing these days? Do you stay in touch with him or no?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. He's living in Florida, playing golf, looking at the waves. His wife Annie's with him, who is hysterical in her own way. She's very fun. And he's having a very enjoyable life.
Good for him. He deserves it.
Yeah.
He deserves it.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. I'm a fan.
This,
yeah, I'm a fan of John Byner. So
everybody loves John. I think he's probably, one of the few people in the industry who didn't have any enemies. You know, I mean, everybody loved John. So.
Yeah, he was
I sure
so
did.
Funny.
We just had a lot of fun.
Right. Now, what made you want to do the Howard Hughes book, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes? And how true is that? I mean, is it true stories? And how'd you get your information? I mean, John, you hung out with, you had everything on him. How'd you get the information on Howard Hughes other than major research, obviously? I'm just curious who you spoke to and stuff.
One of the interesting things in my writing career is I've never gone looking for a story. They've always come to me. And a long time ago, I was doing some consulting for the government, and one of the people on the team was a major general by the name of Mark Musick. And Mark and I are, we're like the same, we're just the same kind of guy, and we like the same things in history, and, And so he, our other friend, Colonel, called me one day and said, Mark and I, Mark just brought me something that's a really strange story, and I don't even want to try and tell you what it is on the phone, but we'd like to come out to Los Angeles and tell you about it. Okay, fine. Well, that was what became Boxes of the Secret Life of Howard Hughes. And Mark had found this strange story, and it was revolved on a woman named Eva McClellan, who claimed, and I believe, was married to Howard Hughes. And Hughes, at that time, was trying to escape his other life because, among other things, everyone in the world is suing him. But he just wanted some peace and quiet. And so Mark brought in a stack of three-ring binders that was about a foot tall. And he said, "What do you show you?" And he said, "I've been researching this for 6 years before I even bothered to bring this to you." And I looked at the material, quickly, and I said, I, Mark, there's no way I can tell whether it's true or not, but it sure is interesting. And so, I'll hop in on you with this one. And once we started, it was interesting because the story sounds completely screwy, but when we investigated it and found things that we could confirm and put together, suddenly, when the first edition of the book was printed in, I think it was 2010, I, at that point, this is a very complicated story, among other things. It took me a while to put together in a way that anybody could understand. But when the first edition was published, I was about 90% convinced that it was true. I really wasn't all the way yet. And very shortly after the book was published, we started getting phone calls about, you know what you just did here? I know something about that. And the calls kept coming in, and the information started coming in. And there was one particular piece of information, which was a, it's like a lapel pin, the premise of the story, by the way, is that the Howard Hughes who was buried was not Howard Hughes. That was someone else who to throw everybody off.
Is that what boxes means? Empty boxes?
Boxes, yes, because boxes because the person he was using the name of a disappeared CIA operative by the name of Werner Nicely. He was working for the CIA in Central America. He just didn't come back. And so because Howard was so completely connected with the CIA, suddenly this guy shows up who looks like Howard Hughes, but he changed the name instead of Werner Nicely. He changed it to Werner Nicely. And we started poking around into that and discovered all, there's medical records, there's all kinds of things that show that, he's Hughes. And it was known that Hughes had people, body doubles that he would use.
Wait a minute. So now the death of Howard Hughes, was it real or did he die before or after? I mean, I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything, but I mean, if he was so cunning.
it is. He had, you know, the long fingernailed, long haired, crazy drug addict guy existed. It just wasn't Hughes. And they took care of him and made it look like it was Hughes. And there were two reasons for that. One of which was that if they ever did catch up with this long haired crazy guy, and in terms of, you know, they couldn't file papers on him because he was clearly crazy. You know, so he'd saved himself from that. And that's the one who died on an airplane coming back from Acapulco. And he was buried as Howard Hughes. Nobody from his staff showed up for the funeral. Isn't that kind of interesting, you think? Yeah, no one showed up except one person from the CIA who said, you know, he did a fine thing for his country. The body that came back was so emaciated that they had a very difficult time. They had to call an expert to get fingerprints off of them, but they finally did. The fingerprints were collected by the FBI and have not been seen since.
Wow.
Of course, now we've got prints of you know, so let's, you know, so we went, got a hold of the FBI and said, hey, you know, we'd like a copy of those prints. And it was like, oh, you better go away quickly. So, you know, there's all kinds of interesting things. There is, I have a copy of the book in front of me, and I don't know that I can find the
Let me ask you real quick while you're grabbing the book. Do you think that story is true about him getting picked up on the side of the road? I don't remember. I think they did a movie on
in
it.
In Melvin Dumar. Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely do. And that's, I mean, that's world-class crazy along with everything else. But there is a, see, this is part of the complexity of that book.
The complexity of the man. I mean, just a whole, what a story about this guy. I mean, your book, I bet it's amazing. I'm sorry I haven't read it.
When Melvin Dumar, when this all came in to court, the Hughes estate was fighting, of course, Dumar along with everyone else. And they brought in Noah Dietrich, who was Hughes' right-hand man. He brought in a private investigator by the name of Jim Spiller, who started poking into all of these things. And he uncovered the trail of the, you know, the handwritten, what became known as the Mormon Rill.
Yeah.
He tracked the whole thing down, and he had everything laid out. There was an FBI, a retired FBI agent by the name of Gary Magnuson involved. They completely, as far as I'm concerned, they completely proved that Dumar was the real deal. The problem went back to when the what became known as the Mormon will was delivered to Melvin at the gas station that he worked at. And when he looked at it, he kind of freaked out. It's not every day that somebody, you know, drops in and hands you a pile of money. The guy who delivered the letter was a well-known Hughes operative and muscle, to put it unbluntly, you know.
It all fit together.
But Melvin.
Right. Why would they give him money if it wasn't true? Why would one of Howard's people give him money? You know,
exactly.
I just was always curious if it was fiction or
not. And Melvin, you know, when he was looking at $1 million, he kind of freaked out. He didn't know what to do with it. So he took it up to the Mormon headquarters in Salt Lake City. You know, he didn't know what to do. So he took it into Mormon headquarters, left the letter there, and went away, which kind of sort of would have worked, except the FBI got their hands on it. He said that he had nothing to do with the letter. Well, they found his fingerprints on it, and that put a big dent in his credibility. And then he said, all right, I had the letter. I was confused. I didn't know what to do. And that killed him with the jury. But
right.
And I spoke with Melvin. He's now deceased, of course.
Mm.
But I'm absolutely 100% certain that he really did pick up Howard. Jim Spiller is 100% certain that he picked up Howard. And Magnuson, the FBI agent, is 100% sure. But they didn't convince the jury. So
crazy. I didn't know if that was a true story or not, if it just, you know, made for TV. But did he, Go ahead.
Yeah, once you start poking into a story like that, you know people are going to come out of the woodwork.
Oh, and they
challenge
did, yeah. Yeah,
so when you look at the book, I painstakingly sourced all of this material from people who are, you know, beyond reproach. So if people want to argue about something, say, okay, well, look, there's the citation. You can go back and you can look that up. Some of these people, doctors and things, are still alive. Go talk to them. I've noted it. Just so you could do that.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I always was fascinated by him. I'm off the top of my head, it's been a while, but did he have like a bone debilitating problem or his back or some kind of disease? I can't remember. Something. He had something wrong with him.
He was notorious for banging into things. Shortly after World War II, he designed an experimental aircraft.
Yeah.
And he was doing the test flight, and he had it was counter-rotating propellers, and one of them went in the wrong direction, and he was suddenly in for an unexpected ride. He tried to make, I think it was the Wilshire Los Angeles Country Club or the Wilshire Country Club. He tried to hit one of the fairways, to land on one of the fairways, and he missed. And he hit a couple of houses, and he broke, I think, everything.
Wow.
Plus being burned. Yeah, plus being burned.
And
they did not expect him to live. And among the repercussions for that, not only did his body have multiple issues, but they expected him to die.
Yeah.
And so they treated him with morphine to the point of keeping him really, really comfortable, which makes sense if he was going to die. But he fooled him and he didn't die. So he lived with an addiction, the morphine addiction, that he couldn't kick. And then later in life, he was in debilitating pain too, though.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so then eventually when he was married to Eva, he developed cancer, and that's ultimately what took him out of the game.
Yeah. I would think that after that plane crash too, that maybe that was part of his start of becoming a recluse as well, you know, so
it started around that time. And I believe that he always had a social anxiety from day one. But I think around there he started losing his grip, and part of the business of hiding behind impersonators was, you know, keep people away from me. I don't want to talk to them.
Right. Well, again, I don't want to focus too much on that one. What I really want to ask you now, you started the conversation, and I feel the same way as you. Funny is better all the time. So how did you go from comedy to writing these true, serious stories, specifically a teenage girl in Auschwitz? I mean, that story alone has got to be heart-wrenching. And how did you pivot to that? And
as I said earlier, I never went looking for any of these things. General Music brought me the Howard Hughes story.
Right.
And then not too long after that, this is an interesting, the surviving Hiroshima. I was at home one afternoon and my cell phone rang and it was my publisher. My publisher never calls me. We do texts, we do emails, we do, you know, all of those things. But we never talk, rarely, unless it's some scheduled problem we have to do with. We never talk on the phone. So the cell phone rings, and it's Terry, and she says, I just got off the guy, or got off the phone with a very interesting man. His mother survived the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, and he'd like somebody to tell the story. And she said, you know, Doug, this one's got you written all over it. Do you want it?
Hmm.
Sure. And that's how I met Tony Drago. That, as I say, that came to me. I didn't go looking for him.
Right.
Tony's a terrific guy, and the process of writing the book was extremely interesting. And, you know, I enjoyed it very much. It, you know, took time, of course. I enjoyed that very much. And then, you know, John Biner called and, you know, said, what are you doing for the next 2 years? And so that was his book. And then the church I go to, they were hosting a missionary, a female missionary from Burma.
Hmm.
And they introduced me to her. And one of her friends, one of the people in the congregation came up. Her name is Sharon Porterfield. And this woman walked up, and I knew the woman very well. She walked up to me and she said, you will write Sharon's story. Okay, well, that sounds like a director. But then I got together with Sharon, and it was absolutely fun. The amount of, she dedicated her life to helping and teaching the Karen people in Burma, at the expense of really her own life. You know, I mean, she had a very wealthy childhood in Southern California, and now she's off in Burma, without a toilet. You know, I mean, that's a pretty big dive. You know, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that was fascinating. So, and she's a lovely woman, so I wrote her book. And that was an intro. That was God sent me.
Yeah,
and then
teenage girl in Auschwitz come to you then?
I think I said my little retirement job is I go into the hospital 3 days of work and 3 days a week and a chaplain, and I met a couple of people in the hospital, very nice people, and we became friends. And the woman heard that I wrote books, and so she picked up a copy of Surviving Hiroshima, and she called me and she said, I just read this book, and I went to college with a woman whose grandmother survived Auschwitz. Would you like to talk to the family? I think I would, by the way.
Exactly.
And so that's when that one came around, and that was a whopping great emotional ride for me.
That's why I asked, going from comedy to this, because this has got to be some heart-wrenching stuff in here for this young girl.
It was.
Who's now,
you know, I have this background as a, historian. That's maybe a bit more of a grandiose title than I deserve, but I'm interested in that. And when I called her daughter, and we, started to have the conversation about my writing the book, she said, well, my mother recorded two testimonies, one for Graz College and the other one for the University of Southern California, Shoah Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I can get you those testimonies if you want. I said, well, great. So the Graz College testimony came in a transcript. It was written. That's what I need. You know, I can't go spinning through tape looking at things. I need a transcript. But the one from USC came as a videotape. Now, I don't know if they didn't have a transcript or what, but it came as a videotape. And I watched a couple of minutes of it. And Basha had a, slight accent. She spoke, I think, 7 languages, but she had an accent. And in this transcript, there are Polish words, German words, Russian words, Hebrew words, and Yiddish words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, if I send this to a transcription service, I have absolutely no idea what I'll get back. So the only way to do this is to transcribe it myself, which was a good idea. However, as I was doing the transcription, I was watching her on the videotape. tell that story, realizing that all of this was happening to her when she was 14 years old.
Wow.
And, you know, I work in ICU. You know, I mean, if I haven't seen everything yet, I got to be getting close.
Right.
But watching her as she told that story, I'm a pretty solid guy for that kind of thing. But I stopped three or four times when I was transcribing that, because, you know, I would say to myself, you know what, I think that's enough of that for today.
That was
step one. I got pulled into that. And then with her daughter, Evelyn, now suddenly I feel like I'm part of the family. And
so that book
became a really emotional and personal ride for me. And I'm grateful for that. And I got to tell you, there's three things about that book that are critically important. I started it to add to the historical record of what went on in those camps.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of this is that Basha promised her mother on the train station platform in Auschwitz. Mm. Her mother said to her, "You have to live to tell our story."
Wow.
Now, for Basha, she says, a promise to a parent was holy. You could not break that.
Right.
And when all of these things started to happen to her in Auschwitz, I believe it was her refusal to break that promise. And when she did that, she reached inside herself to find that inner strength and power that I believe is in each and every one of us. And I say that from my own personal experience.
Right.
And I saw that and I went, okay, I have to bring that out in this story. People need to know that the difference between Basha's life and death was her tapping into that inner strength and keeping going. And then the third part of this is I look at this as a historical warning. You know, we all know history repeats itself. And I look at elements of Nazism, and I see
it's
things
happening
going
right
on
before our eyes. It's happening right before
there you
our
go.
Eyes.
Right
yep.
before our eyes. One of yep. my big concerns, having worked in
and
the media
same
for
thing
years,
happened, and the same thing happened back then. It happened right before everybody's eyes, and no one did anything.
No one did anything. And you look at my big concern here is control of information.
Mm-hmm.
In 1933, Hitler took control of all media.
Right.
And so the only thing that went on radio or newspapers or anything was what Hitler and the Nazis wanted to go out
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Right.
And because they controlled everything, there was no way to get the truth out.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, the Nazi policy was that Jews were subhuman and not worthy of life. So if you were in Germany listening to that all the time, and particularly if you were a young person who had gone through the Hitler Youth programs, that was the only story. And so they believed it. And so now Basha ends up at 14 years old, in a concentration camp where the young guards totally believe that she is subhuman along with all of her friends and have no right, because there was no one to tell them the truth. All right, now we look at our world today.
And
I think I said earlier, back when I started in TV, you could only own 7 broadcast licenses, and you couldn't own a newspaper and a broadcast license in the same town because the government was very concerned that someone could control information for their own purposes.
Hello,
so today,
Fox.
They dumped that policy in the 80s And now corporate entities grab all of the stations that they want, whenever they want. They're in complete control. I was teaching a class here at the local university, and I was essentially warning my students to be careful what you accept as the truth. And
right.
I showed them the charts. And in these ownership charts, by the time you got through with all this corporate ownership, there were a little more than 200 people at the top of the pile who were running things. And they were all, they all say pretty much the same thing. And that's not the way it used to be. When I was young, I watched something on a news show on one channel, and then I'd check it against another channel and see if they say the same thing, or look at a newspaper. Now, when you do that, because of all these corporations who own all of these media outlets and all think the same, you hear this and you go, I would have, said, you hear all these people say the same thing, so I guess it must be the truth. That's the way it used to be. Well, it doesn't play anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's only a handful of people, and they're going to only tell you what they want you to know.
Right.
And that is my concern. I say to people, okay, you're getting this information. Stop. Where does it come from? Who is really in charge of this? I got, probably 4 years ago, I got local news stories from local TV stations, 9 of them. And the stories were word for word identical from all these local stations from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, I look at that. Well, obviously the local station they weren't writing these stories. So who did write them? And how do I know they're true?
Right.
That's my concern.
Right. Now, a stupid question. I don't even know if you could answer it, but what do you think is the reason people believe the nonsense that's out there? And not only that, I have an issue with the free speech thing. Free speech doesn't mean free to lie, okay? In my opinion, that's the way I was brought up,
I got to tell you, I understand what you're saying, absolutely. Here's my problem with that. I'm 100% free speech.
Mm-hmm,
because if you say, okay, we can all talk about this, except those people over there, because those people, we don't trust them. So we're not going to let them talk, but everybody else can talk. And then the line moves. Those people can't talk, and probably those people shouldn't talk. There's no two that don't talk. And this thing builds until you eventually get to the point where you're once again in a situation where the only people who can talk are those that are in agreement with whoever is controlling that particular part of media. What happens is, at least in my opinion, you let everybody talk. There are morons. There are hate-filled people. There are all kinds of things out there.
Yeah.
So, in my opinion, go ahead and let them talk, because there are still people who can combat that with free speech. You don't have to listen to that and say and ignore it. You can fight back. Unlike in the Third Reich, where the lies were out there, but nobody else could cover them. And so I think the only way to have truly free speech is to really allow everyone to speak. And all the time I'm confronted with people saying things that, just make me want to hold my head and scream. But if we start chipping away with that freedom, eventually there won't be much freedom left.
Right. Well, they're taking everything away from us now. So, you know, it's just, I don't know. Listen, you're a man who's been around. I won't say anything regarding age, but you've been around. What do you think about this craziness going on right now in this world that we've got going on with everything you've grown up seeing?
See, this is another thing. I can tell you, I'm 73 years old. I've been around for a while.
Yeah,
I've worked,
say you're a man about town. You've been around.
And I've worked around the world. I've worked in the Middle East.
Yeah.
If there's another problem, education. If certain things aren't allowed to be talked about so we can focus on other things. You know, back in the area where I went to school, I saw a news story that the local schools were going to back off on teaching history and mathematics so they had more time to focus on social things.
Oh,
like,
my God.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like gender and, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Okay, you can talk about gender and whatever, but if you can't, the world runs on mathematics. If you have
right.
no understanding of that, you're in trouble. And if you don't know history and can't have a conversation like you and I are having, you know, about the censorship in Germany and propaganda, if you don't know that those things exist, how are you going to tell censorship and propaganda when you confront it as an adult in your own life?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So
I know.
A short answer to that question would have been, it drives me crazy. But, you know.
Well, I never thought I would see anything like this in my lifetime in the United States of America. That's number one. I'll just add my peace of mind on there. And I knew there were stupid people out there. I just didn't know how many. Number two, and the internet should not be able, if it's not true, you shouldn't be able to post it. That's number three. Let's see, what else was I going to, I could go on and on and on. I just never thought I'd experience in my life anything like this in my lifetime, thing like this in my lifetime ever. So anyway, let's get back to Basha. So again, the book is A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Basha Freilich and the Will to Live. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is it Freilich?
Freilich, yeah.
Freilich,
You know, I should probably at this point mention that this story has a happy ending.
Yeah, well, you got to talk to her all these years later. That's a happy ending for sure.
Yeah, there's all of these things that happen, yet, and this gets back to this point about reaching deep inside herself.
Right.
She won that battle. Had she not made that promise to her mother, I don't think she would have survived.
Yeah.
But she did that.
Obviously, her. I'm sorry, Doug. Her mom did not survive, I'm assuming.
No, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Within minutes after that conversation, she saw her mother and two of her brothers. They were attempting to be loaded on a truck. And,
yeah.
And one of the SS agents gave her mother a sound whack over the head, and that was the last she saw of her.
Last image of your mom. Anyway, ugh.
Yeah, but once Basha was out of the camp, you know, she had a lot of other stuff coming. But it was that survival will, and I'll say this again, I believe that's in each and every one of us.
Yeah.
If we go looking for it, if we understand it's there. And she and her husband, Samuel, came to the United States. And Basha pulled that out again. She decided they were going to start a business. And by golly, they did. And it was a successful business.
What business
and they
did
had
they?
They started a shoe business.
Nice.
And that allowed them to acquire enough customers that they had financial security. They got to move to the suburbs and buy a house. They got to go to almost monthly concentration Holocaust survivors dinners. They had balls. I mean, formal gowns and things. They could live their lives.
Sure,
they were
celebrating life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, and they had wonderful children. I have enjoyed talking with Evelyn very much, and grandchildren, and they went on. She won. They didn't conquer her. She found that inside of her, and she didn't quit. And I love that. When I saw that in the story, I said, "This, all right, I'm all in on her."
Yeah. Well, I have to agree with you. I think that we all have it inside of us, but God forbid we ever have to find out. I hope I never have to find out, but do we have it in us when push comes to shove, if you get to that point, unfortunately.
I certainly would not want to have to find it the way she did. In my own life, I found it, but nowhere near as harrowing circumstances. And if we go back and look at surviving Hiroshima, that's another case where the young woman who, Kalaria Palchikov, she was 22 when the bomb got dropped on them. I can't imagine what the devastation was like. But
fascinating story of history.
Yeah, she went and volunteered to work in Army field hospitals. They had all these people with no medications to treat them, no cots to put them on, but she jumped in there and she found it. And she said, "I'm here to help. I'm doing this. I'm not going to fold. I'm here." Remarkable. Remarkable.
Mm. Good question on Basha. Is she still with us?
No, she died, I believe, in 2022. She was born in 1928, which is another interesting thing when it comes to research. When young people were sent to the concentration camps, if they were young, they were pretty much not going to survive. They would go directly to the gas chambers. If they looked like they might have some value for labor, then they had a chance of surviving. So it was common, and I think what Basha did was she added 2 years to her age to give her a little edge toward survival. She said she was born in 1926, but everything I can find shows 1928. And then, of course,
pretty smart.
Yeah. When she emigrated to the United States, then of course that date came with her.
Was a problem.
So unraveling those records turned into a real bear. But you have to be persistent. And if you're going to get it done, you just say, "All right, I'm just going to do this. I'm not going to quit. And one way or another, I'll figure this out."
Right.
And that's what I did.
How long did it take you to write this one?
Somebody asked me that the other day, and I said, I deliberately stopped counting days because...
Wow. Was this the longest one? Was this the longest one, Doug?
Longest, I would say I couldn't involve myself completely in it immediately because I was still finishing God Sent Me. But I got into it, and I started with the transcripts, and then... there was a long, painful research process, and the fact that the Nazis and American immigration changed people's names and their birth dates were changed, that was pretty challenging.
That must have been digging like a needle in a haystack trying to figure all that out. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I had, I think 5 spellings of Basha's last name. I didn't know which one was right. And Evelyn, who's Basha's daughter, she wasn't entirely certain either. And so that required going through names of relatives and trying to track down what name got changed to what. So Anush, the way it's spelled A-N-U-S-H in the book, that's as close as we could come up with for the family name. because right. all of those family records were destroyed by the Nazis. As you know, the Jewish people keep very detailed family histories, and which made them prime target for the Nazis. That was another way of getting back a mental torture against against the Jewish people. And so there was no historical records, just what I could poke around and, you know, assemble bits and pieces of things here and then come up with, you know, what I felt was reliable. And I, in the book, where I don't know something for sure, I say, right. I don't know this for sure, but this is the way it looks.
Yeah.
Even finding the correct ages for her siblings was complicated. And I think part of that was for the same reason Basha changed
right.
her date. Maybe they changed theirs. I don't know.
Right.
But I never did find the exact correct birth date for any of her siblings. I had to make calculations based on, well, if they were over there and the date was that, and this was about a year later, then they must have been, you know, just trying to get estimates that worked with events. So in the book, it says there are a lot of places where I would say, well, this family member was born somewhere between this date, because that's just the best thing to do.
No specific. No records. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a quick question for you about Basha and her family in Poland before they came and raided her house and took them from their house. Were they fairly well off or no?
No, it was
financially.
Because
they weren't selective. I know they preferred probably to go for people that they could steal from, but, you know, I know they weren't selective. They went for all of them, so.
Yeah. Basha's father, Isaac, worked very, very hard to support his family. And they did fine until first the Russians moved in and started controlling food supplies and things like that. And he did his best. They also, he was a kosher butcher, and they made kosher butchering illegal, so he had to try and sneak butcher people, and so he did that. He at some point was buying horses out of town and traded them. He just did a lot of things to anything he did to support his family.
Yeah.
Now Basha, the woman who would eventually become Basha's sister-in-law, Dora Globiewicz, was the other side of the thing. They, her father owned a bakery, and they were quite well off, and they had everything, and you know, it was a completely different lifestyle from Basha.
Right.
However,
uh-huh.
when the Russians came in, you know, anyone who owned a business was an exploiter, according to the Russians. You exploit people if they work for you, even though you're paying them.
They
essentially seized his bakery, and they allowed him, in fact, they forced him to work at it, work in the bakery, without paying him. He was supposed to live off his savings. And so suddenly that family went from being pretty well off
to nothing.
Having to struggle.
Yeah, it's just crazy how, you know, it's like, what did a Jewish person do to Adolf Hitler to piss him off so bad? Or is it, you know, just because they weren't Christians or Catholic, whatever? I mean, it's just crazy. I thank God. Well, I used to thank God I lived in America. I mean, now it's just so, I'm just disgusted. Sorry. I can't help myself.
Unfortunately, we're having one great big cringe moment.
Absolutely.
And I say to people, I believe we are in the middle of the world's biggest sucker play, and we are the suckers. I never, never thought that I would make any statement anywhere near that.
Yep. Me too. Me too. I never thought I'd see what I'm seeing. That's for damn sure. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Real quick before we go, we'll touch on the book again before we go. Are you still involved with the homeless?
No, I'm right up now. I stick to the hospital chaplaincy, primarily in the intensive care unit, although I'll go anywhere. I tell people if the phone rings, I answer it, and off I go. I had 6 years of homeless ministry in Los Angeles, and then when we left Los Angeles, I picked up with a prison ministry here, and then I discovered that roughly 70% of the prisoners were incarcerated for things involving drugs. And so the state of Utah graciously paid for me to go to school to get a drug counseling license. So I do that here. I have my chaplaincy. I have my drug counseling. We don't have a lot of homeless, really, in where I live. There's more recently than there were. It's not an enormous problem here. Los Angeles, I can't believe, you know, I see pictures of my neighborhood where I lived in Los Angeles. We had a beautiful house. I designed it and then got somebody to, you know, to build it. And it was in a terrific neighborhood. And I had every single thing I wanted, and I look now at what I'm seeing on television about that neighborhood, and it's trash and criminals and insanity.
It's crazy times. Yeah.
How could that happen in such a brief period of time? It's such a wonderful place.
Yeah. Well, it's happening everywhere, unfortunately, and I don't know how to fix it. I really don't. I don't know how to fix it. I wish I did, but we got to do something. Something's got to be done. So when's the chaplain book coming out about your experiences as being a chaplain and working with
I don't know. I've been thinking about that, but I'll tell you one that just floated. I don't know how much time we have. One that just floated to the surface. Long ago, after I was out of the government consulting thing, but I was, I'm piddling around with other things. And one of the people that I met in this government team said, I are you still working on number something, something I was working with? And I said, I'm still working on that. And they said, I found somebody who knows something about it. Do you want to talk to her? Fine. Okay. And so we had a conversation, and then she said, I have something else I feel I need to tell you this. And so I'm going to tell you, but you can't print it and you can't use my name or there are people who will kill me. So okay. That's
oh boy.
Nice.
Here we go.
And so I saved in the material. I did not print it or use it anyway, but the material is about the assassinations of JFK and RFK. And Robert Kennedy Jr. has been talking about the murder of his father as well as JFK. And this person who gave me that information, I verified a little. I didn't have time to do too much with it, but I have names and how much people were paid, and it's all sitting somewhere. Here's the problem. Yeah. That was so long ago. I put it aside somewhere, and I have to look for those hard drives. I don't know where they are. But if I can find them, I'm considering contacting Robert Kennedy and saying, hey, you know what? I know something about this, too. You want to talk? Let's see what happens.
Well, if you talk to him, tell him to stay out of the race. He's not a real Kennedy, sorry, in my opinion. But anyway, he's not a true Democrat.
I'll be sure I let
Kennedy.
Him know on that. You know.
Yeah. Tell them, please don't run. We don't need any more crazies. So, but I did want to ask you. Oh, do you know John Barber? He's done a three-part series.
He's done a three-part series
on JFK and the assassination.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's got a thing coming up. You're not in L.A., right? He's got a thing coming for the anniversary on the 22nd. What's it called? Hold on, let me grab a quick piece of paper. He's been doing, I got him in here somewhere. Hold on one moment. I don't mean to go off topic, but I think you'd be interested in what he's got to say, because he believes the CIA, he talked to Garrison and everything, and I don't have it in front of me, I'm sorry. But he's got the 22nd, he's airing his third and final part series of the JFK assassination. He said he spent like half of his life working on it, and he's done, so... But he has proof that the CIA was involved, so I don't know.
I believe it, but not only do I believe it, I know it. So,
yep.
Isn't that a nice, cozy, you know, it doesn't make you feel warm
exactly.
All over.
Yep. That's the one thing I got to say about what I've learned over the last 6 years. I always knew we were a little corrupt, but I never knew how bad until now, our government is so corrupt.
I don't think we have ever even come close to where we are now.
Absolutely
amazing.
Not.
Amazing.
Yep.
So.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's just let everybody know. You can go to DouglasWellmanAuthor.com to find out more about Douglas, obviously, and to get his books there. And they're all online, wherever you can get your books, and at Barnes & Noble. I'm sure they're everywhere, right, Douglas?
Yep, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And bookstores are a little unpredictable because there's like something like 3,000 new books a week published. So bookstores, kind of tough to know what they're going to stock and what they aren't. But they're easily accessible online from a number of sales companies. And on my website, DouglasWellmanAuthor.com, each of my books has links to several booksellers and
They
can get it that way.
The outlets. Mm-hmm. Well, guys,
I urge people to pay attention to what's going on around them, and don't just accept whatever you hear, even if it's from somebody supposedly important. Just don't accept it without checking it.
And just because somebody speaks louder than somebody else and yells over them doesn't make them right. So anyway, go check out Doug's books, Surviving Hiroshima, I say it Hiroshima, A Young Woman's Story, God Sent Me, A Woman Missionary in the Jungle, 5 Minutes, Mr. Biner, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, and now another true story of a 14-year-old girl from Poland who wound up in Auschwitz at the age of 14. And that book is called A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Basia Freilich, and The Will to Live. And what an amazing story that must be. I mean, just...
And it has a happy ending, but I have to keep telling people, it does have a happy ending.
Yeah, and just you talking about it, I can hear in your voice that it definitely had an effect on you covering this this story for sure. I can't imagine how it wouldn't. I mean, just reading it, I'm thinking about it. It's got to be heart-wrenching, absolutely heart-wrenching.
Yeah. It was a tough
one. Yeah. Well, Doug, thank you so very much. It was a pleasure meeting you, sir, and please come back anytime.
I have enjoyed this very much. I like you. You have a sense of humor and a functioning mind. In my world, that's pretty much enough to put you over the top.
Well, I told you were going to have a good time. I don't lie, and I keep my promises. That's for sure. But please, I would love to have you back anytime you want to chat. The same here. I love speaking to people who know what the heck they're talking about, and you know.
let's do that. We're in a crazy time. Let's do that, and I'll maybe chip a little something off of the big block of my life here, and we can bat that around. I'll find something that will thank everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, please don't hesitate. I don't think you have my direct number. The number you called on is only available when we're on the air. So I could, Ross has my number. You could ask Ross for my number.
Okay,
on my email.
I'll take care of that.
Well, my email
is
applauseradioshow@gmail.com. Yeah, right. applauseradioshow@gmail.com if anybody wants to email us. And again, real quick, if anybody has any holiday or Christmas-related music or project, give us the email. We'd love to have you on in December trying to spread some cheer in these crazy times. And I'd love to be part of that because we need to be happy, folks. We got to remember that, you know, life is what we make of it. And again, Doug is absolutely right. Pay attention. Stop listening to the wrong people. And when you see RFK Jr., tell him, please save America and don't run, please.
I'll point that out right away, okay?
Yeah, I'm only kidding. Oh, Doug, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure, sir. Thank you so much. I really
thank
enjoyed
you,
our conversation, too. So I appreciate it. Everybody, Douglas Wellman, go to www.douglaswellmanauthor.com to find the books. Go online to find the books. Go anywhere to find the books. And find out more about Doug over there at his website. And check out the new one. Well, check them all out. I'm interested in all four, to be quite honest. The new one is A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Basha Freilich, and The Will to Live. I mean, the title says it all. And a 14-year-old girl. Back in the 40s, I mean, you think we're struggling now. You don't know what struggle is, like Basha has.
Well,
so,
Joanne,
yeah.
Joanne, in my other business, I say, God bless you. So let me throw that one at you, too.
Oh, God bless you, too. And listen, we can all use the help we can get, you know, every little bit.
We'll do this again soon.
You got it. It was a pleasure. Everybody, Douglas Wellman. Doug, take care. It was a pleasure. Have a good night. Everybody go pick up the book, A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Basha Freilich, and The Will to Live, and go check out all his other books at douglaswellmanauthor.com. And, Doug, again, thank you. What a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
A happy Thanksgiving. Have a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Thank you, and you too. Eating is not always... a little rare sometimes with all the work going on, so that's a good idea.
Take some time to consume
a turkey with you and my
brother. You're going to consume a whole turkey. Oh my God, I'm more of a what's the little chickens? I forgot what they're called. Oh, not the hen.
Cornish.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm more of that. I'm not a turkey. Cornish game hen. That's what I am.
All the best to you.
You too, sir. Thank you. Douglas Wellman, everybody. Take care, Doug, and a happy Thanksgiving to you. And please keep in touch. I'd love to have you back or just to shoot the crap.
Ah, crap shooting is one of my favorite things. All right, we'll do that.
I know.
Bye-bye.
Me too. Take care. Bye-bye, Doug.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Douglas Wellman, everybody. Oh, boy, I could talk to him for hours. Oh, my God. Geez. Like he said, pay attention, folks. I mean, you don't... I don't know why people believe what they're believing. Your country is deteriorating before your eyes, and how you can believe the nonsense that is going on is just beyond me, and how these people thought they could get away with what they tried to do and are still trying to do, all because of one mouth that roars. It's funny how it's such a witch hunt, but everybody pleaded guilty in it, right? So no witch hunt there. I mean, they don't want to go to jail for him. Anyway, I'm not mentioning names. I don't like to do politics on the air, but something's got to give, folks. We got to let it go. Somebody's got to wake up, do something. I did hear that they're considering indicting the senators and congressmen that took part in trying to overturn our election. Yes, the election was stolen by one person, Donald Trump. So, sadly, you believe them. And how, I don't know. I don't know how people can believe the nonsense. So anyway, we won't be back until, we got Thanksgiving this week. On the 26th, we got writer, producer, performer, classic TV aficionado, Herbie J. Pilato. We're going to have a lot of fun on the 26th at 9 p.m. Eastern. He's got some great books, Bewitched, Mary Tyler Moore, He's written scripts. I mean, he's done everything. I can't wait to hang out with him. We're going to have a good time. And we're looking really good for December. My goodness, we're so booked up. And for those of you who tuned in last night, the 19th, for your free psychic readings with Michelle, she will be back on December 3rd. We had a little faux pas last night. I had set that broadcast up while I had COVID pretty bad. And COVID brain, I think they call it. I just wasn't clear. I was very foggy. So anyway, I set it up for 8 a.m. instead of 8 p.m. And really, which room wasn't an issue because I still could have set up a broadcast prior to 8 p.m. And I did attempt to do that. And unfortunately, I wasn't allowed to. And I gave it plenty of time. And Albert Bouchard is going to be back on the 5th. of December. He's from Blue Oyster Cult. He was supposed to join us last week, but I had to cancel because of COVID. And Rick Ryan's coming back to the show. We're going to talk about his Christmas songs, his new book that he's got out, the Under Santa's Hat. That's going to be pretty cool. Dennis Provisor from Grassroots is going to be on. Oh, for your Big Brother fans, I'm excited about this one. I'm excited about all of them, to be honest. Angela Rockstar from Big Brother is going to be on. I watched that show relentlessly. I've been watching it since it started, so dying to hear her opinion of what she thought of this season that just passed. So, and then Kathy Garver will be back. Sissy from Family Affair. And we're still got some open dates. I'm holding them for some Christmas tunes or Christmas projects. So if you have anything, professional or not, we want to have you on. You got a new movie out, a song? Send us an email. applauseradioshow@gmail.com. I'd love to have you on. Let's spread some holiday cheer and let's spread the word about you. Okay? So I have no problem doing that. So please reach out. And we will see you guys again the 26th, it is? Yeah, the 26th with Herbie J. Pilato. So I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving, a safe holiday. And remember, COVID's out there. I give after 3 years, I got it. So I honestly was starting to think that it wasn't real because after 3 years, I never got it. So I finally got it. It got me. And so now that we're going to be enclosed and everything and the weather, it's getting cold again. So people are inside and it's just, you never know. So take care of yourselves and enjoy whatever you do with your family, your friends, whatever you do on Thanksgiving. Be grateful for everything you have because a lot of people don't have it as good as you, even though if you think you don't have it so good, okay? Always be grateful for everything we have, especially waking up every day. That's one big, 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 big plus, okay? So thank you again to author Douglas Wellman. Check out his book, A Teenage Girl in Auschwitz, Basha Freilich, and a girl and her will to live. I don't want to mispronounce that. Hang on, let me say it from here. Basha Freilich and the Will to Live. I mean, what more can you say? What more can you say? And again, he's right. Just a little bit of history repeating. Wake up, folks. Wake up. All right, check it out. www.douglaswellmanauthor.com for more information on Doug and to get his books. And also they're everywhere online and anywhere you get your books. So, yeah, we'll see you soon. Happy Thanksgiving. What are we going to close with tonight? I feel a little bit like Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods. That always picks me up. I love the 60s. I love the bubblegum stuff. It makes me so happy. All right, guys, enjoy. Happy Thanksgiving. Take care. Bye-bye.
And we fought, our song would never end. But nothing good lasts forever, so don't cry, it's useless to pretend. It's time to break the chains, go our separate ways. So turn around and leave me, and man.
with every step there is a tear.